one of a number of things that really moved me finally to resign was the US Secretary of State's mischievous presentation to the Security Council on the 5th of February.
The overwhelming feeling was that the world sees what's happening to us and they don't care, and no one's willing to hold Israel responsible for our lives.
So it's really little America saying, enough is enough, we want our civil liberties protected.
There's too much evidence that the CIA informed the administration that they did know about it, and they're now changing their story every other day because someone is not telling the truth.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, July 15th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. British Prime Minister Tony Blair was due to receive the Congressional Gold Medal when he visited Washington today, but that decision has now been scrapped as he faces harsh criticism back in the United Kingdom for his support of President Bush during the war on Iraq. Speaking with the Scotsman newspaper, a member of parliament from Blair's own Labour Party said that accepting the medal would be akin to, quote, taking an award from Satan, unquote. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with California Democratic Representative Henry Waxman. We asked him for his take on this controversy, as well as Bush's inaccurate allegations about Iraq obtaining enriched uranium from the African country of Niger.
I think that it's interesting that Tony Blair is not going to be getting this award. He is going to address a joint session of Congress, which is a great tribute to him by the Republicans who are in charge of our government. But back home, his credibility is very, very low. And I think as people learn more and more about how the Bush administration has handled this whole war in Iraq, our credibility around the world and the president's credibility here at home is also sinking very, very fast.
Did this Congress vote on the decision to give Tony Blair the Congressional Gold Medal? And were you a part of that decision? Is that something you support?
I did not sponsor the resolution. It passed on the calendar where there were no recorded votes requested, so it passed by a voice vote. I think there are a lot of people who are grateful to him for siding with the United States when other countries were at odds with us as we try to get an international coalition together to fight in Iraq. I'll leave the judgment about Tony Blair, for whom I have a lot of regard on other issues, not on this one, dealing with Iraq, mm-hmm. but I have a high regard for him on other issues. But I don't know that having sided with us on the policy where we needed his advice not to pursue the course that we took is worthy of a gold medal.
Mm-hmm. So can we assume that you did not vote in support of a gold medal for Tony Blair?
I didn't vote one way or the other because there wasn't actually a vote.
I see. Okay. Congressman, as you're well aware, there is a controversy currently engulfing the Bush administration in regards to some of the intelligence info used to justify the war in Iraq. The White House has attempted to downplay Bush's inaccurate statements, we now know, about Niger selling enriched uranium to Iraq, saying that this was just 16 words out of an entire State of the Union address and that the case for war revolved around much more than this single point. Why do you think this is so significant?
These are not simply 16 words. These words were the main powerful argument that the administration had to go to war in Iraq, and that was the suggestion that Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, was going to be able to have nuclear weapons if they didn't already have nuclear weapons. And if that were the case, we couldn't wait until we knew that they had them. The president argued that we needed to act quickly to keep it from happening. The idea of nuclear weapons was the real argument, not this weapons of mass destruction vague term for chemical and biological weapons. They're serious, but they're in many cases no more serious than conventional weapons. But nuclear weapons is a whole different matter, and that was driving the president's argument to the Congress and to the people. And we now know that the president's arguments, evidence for Saddam Hussein trying to get a nuclear weapon, was based on erroneous facts. Not only erroneous facts, in the case of the statement in the State of the Union, it was based on a hoax and a forgery. The other piece of evidence that they brought forward was that there were rods which members of Congress were taken to a secure room to look at before the vote on the war resolution, and we were not told that while the administration was presenting these rods as potential parts of a nuclear bomb, mm-hmm. they were really for missile technology and nothing extraordinary.
Well, so does the fact that Bush was wrong on the alleged Niger uranium connection, as well as the failure of U.S. forces to find any clear and convincing evidence of weapons of mass destruction 2.5 months into the occupation, does that throw doubt on other evidence that was used to justify the war, in your opinion, Congressman?
I think it throws doubts on the credibility of this administration's arguments for the war. They argued that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. They have not been able to substantiate that argument. They argued that there were a large amount of weapons of mass destruction. They may still find some, but the argument was discredited when we found that chemical weapons that were supposed to have been available weren't even used in the war itself. But the main argument was the nuclear argument, and that was based on information that the CIA knew to be inaccurate. So I wrote to the president before the war in Iraq and said, if the CIA knew that this evidence you cited in your State of the Union address was based on a hoax, either they didn't communicate it to you, which is massive incompetence, or they communicated it to the administration, and the administration went ahead with a knowing false statement in order to deceive the American people. We haven't really gotten an answer to that. They're trying to blame Tenet at the CIA,
yes.
CIA, but there's too much evidence that the CIA informed the administration that they did know about it, and they're now changing their story every other day because someone is not telling the truth.
Someone, representative, should ultimately be the one to take responsibility for this. In your opinion, is it the commander-in-chief who ultimately has responsibility?
I think the president has to take responsibility for this. It's amazing if you accept his view that the CIA didn't inform the administration, that he isn't demanding that people be fired at the CIA, but instead he's saying, they didn't tell me the truth, but I think George Tenet is doing a wonderful job. How can he say that they're doing a wonderful job when they misled the President of the United States in his State of the Union address? And they're also tricky, because the President's people wanted to say, we know that Iraq has been trying to get nuclear materials from Africa, and the CIA said, you can't say that. So they came back and said, well, we can say that the British are telling us this. That's somewhat accurate because the British were saying it. But the whole idea of making that statement was to mislead people. Mm. It was just too cute by half.
Well, I guess all these issues boil down to the singular question of what did Bush know and when did he know it? What have you concluded thus far, Representative Waxman, from your correspondence with the International Atomic Energy Agency and in your recent letter to the president?
Well, we wrote to the International Atomic Energy Agency and asked them when they found out this evidence about bringing in nuclear materials from Niger was a hoax. And they said, well, as soon as they heard that the president made the statement, they asked for evidence about it. In fact, they asked even earlier, because the statement was made earlier by Colin Powell a couple months before. It took 6 weeks between the request from the agency and the Bush administration before they were given the basis for the statement. And then immediately, as soon as they saw it, they knew it was a fraud. But during that six-week period, Condoleezza Rice used the false information in, ironically enough, a column that she wrote, How Do We Know Saddam Hussein is Lying? Of course, she used a lie to show that he was lying.
Mm-hmm.
And the president used it in his State of the Union address. And then it was also part of the evidence at the U.N., that Saddam Hussein was in violation of the U.N. resolution.
Well,
so they didn't cooperate with the international agency, even though we had commitments and promises that we were going to cooperate with them.
Mm-hmm. There are also reports that Colin Powell decided to leave that information out of his address.
He did leave it out of his address because he was aware that, or his people were aware, that it was a hoax. Now, if he knew, so that meant the State Department knew, and the CIA knew. It's hard to believe that the National Security Council under the president and Condoleezza Rice and others, it's easy enough to know that expect the president to know anything, but these others who advised him and wrote the speech certainly knew that there was something phony about this charge because they were told to rewrite it.
Mm. Everybody seems to be tiptoeing around the L word, lie. And I'm wondering if, well, I know that the Democratic National Convention, as well as a series, you know, a series of television and print ads sponsored by the activist group Win Without War and the website MoveOn.org are appearing across the country, and they're calling for a full congressional inquiry into this issue. Has the president actually lied, in your opinion? Some analysts and historians have compared this to Watergate, and international law professor Francis Boyle, as well as former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, have drafted proposed congressional resolutions of articles of impeachment. Are these actions moving in the right direction, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's premature to reach that conclusion. But I've called for the bipartisan commission to look into all the evidence about the intelligence and how it was used or misused by this administration. And I'm pleased that MoveOn.com is doing a miraculous job of getting signatures on a petition to support a resolution for that commission. Right now, the Congress is undertaking its investigations, but that means nothing to me because it's controlled by the Republicans.
Yes.
They're doing it all behind closed doors. The intelligence agencies can clamp security classifications on anything they say, so they're going to keep everything quiet. I think all this information ought to be out. It ought to be made public. It ought to be reviewed by independent, not congressional, but independent authorities on a bipartisan basis.
And how much bipartisan support is there in the Congress for this type of investigation?
So far, no Republicans are willing to ask for an independent committee to look at the evidence of intelligence failures and the misuse of the intelligence information. The Republicans are well disciplined. It's amazing to me when Clinton was president, there was no accusation too small for them to not want to investigate fully. They issued subpoenas, they called hearings, they did everything they could to explore every possible problem with the Clinton administration. In fact, they made their accusations first and then checked for the facts later and then found the facts didn't substantiate their accusations. With this administration, it's a completely different double standard. There's no scandal too big for them to ignore when it comes to the Bush administration. Now, they're good Republicans, but Congress is supposed to be an independent branch of government, and our checks and balances, that means the Congress is supposed to be exercising oversight with regard to the executive branch, and the Republicans are acting as if they're Republicans first.
Well, but what about the Democrats? Are all of the Democrats on board?
I think that more and more Democrats are coming on board, and I expect that as they see public opinion swell on this issue, we'll get more Democrats and Republicans who won't be able to stand the pressure that Americans don't want all of this swept under the rug and kept from their view. They've trusted this administration, and this administration has betrayed that trust.
Any final thoughts on your part, Representative Henry Waxman?
What, if we step back from all of this, what we have is an administration that was intent on a war in Iraq, and they were willing to distort evidence and misuse relationships internationally in order to pursue that war, and as a consequence, we're bogged down in Iraq, we're isolated internationally, and when it comes to anything else in the world where we have an important reason to deal, on a leadership basis, we're in a weak position for those very real threats that face us.
California Democratic Representative Henry Waxman. As most public services are still inefficient and unemployment remains high, Ahmed Al-Rawi, Peace Watch's Baghdad correspondent, reports that the general mood of the Iraqi people is that of frustration and disappointment with the American administration's slow progress in rebuilding their country's infrastructure. The American allegations that all armed Iraqi resistance is caused by remaining members of the Ba'ath Party and followers of Saddam Hussein are not true, Al-Rawi reports, as resistance also remains high among other segments of Iraqi society.
As the U.S. occupation of Iraq continues through its third month, Iraqi armed resistance activities against U.S. soldiers are increasing. Mohammed Baqir al-Hakim, the famous Shiite leader of the High Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, said in one of his Friday prayers that the popular Iraqi resistance takes three forms: the religious extremists, the nationalists, and the vengeful, who were humiliated by the coalition forces.
Man feels a national motivation and a religious one. He is patriotic, so he would like his nation to be free and independent. And because he is religious, he would not like himself to be under any foreign manipulation. It's in this realm that there are spontaneous reactions. I assert here the word spontaneous, for popular communities commit such acts in an unorganized way, since they were subjected to violent acts by the coalition forces.
According to Al Jazeera Television, two Islamic divisions have claimed responsibility to some of the attacks against American soldiers. One group is called Mujahidu al-Ta'if al-Mansura, or Muslim Fighters of the Victorious Sect, and the other is the Iraqi National Islamic Government, the military divisions of the 1920 revolution. Both groups claim they have nothing to do with Saddam Hussein, and both seem to be Islamic-oriented. But according to Dr. Ahmed al-Kubaisi, the famous Sunni leader and head of the Unified National Movement, there is still no organized Islamic resistance in the country. Isra Shakir, the editor-in-chief of the Iraqi Lyom newspaper, explains what al-Kubaisi says.
The resistance against the Americans is not considered a jihad, since there is no imam announcing a jihad. Any jihad is made by whole communities. What is happening here is caused by individual operations.
On the other hand, many Iraqis believe that the present resistance is a popular national outrage against the misdeeds of some American soldiers who represent the occupying power. The Iraqi society is basically based on tribal alliances and customs. Therefore, any humiliation against its tribal members is considered a grave insult. Abdurrahman Al-Isawi is the editor-in-chief of Al-Aswar newspaper, which is published in Fallujah, a city known for its resistance.
The people who resist are popular groups working in an unorganized way. Their acts are personal reactions against criminal and aggravating actions done by American soldiers.
There have been many incidents where American soldiers break into houses in the middle of night, searching for weapons. Some thefts and maltreatment cases have been also reported, according to Al-Isawi.
The uncivilized and savage means of searching lead consequently to an increase in the resistance activities, making many Iraqis hate and detest these troops.
Many Iraqis say that the American administration should restore public services and security to the country as a first step in restraining people and making them content. Then Iraqis have to feel that they are respected by being allowed to establish their own independent government. This will greatly affect public opinion and build new bridges of trust between the two parties. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ahmed Rawi in Baghdad.
Presidential candidate U.S. Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Ohio held a news briefing today with former intelligence officers on the use of intelligence leading up to the war on Iraq. Joining Kucinich was Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst whose career at the CIA spanned 27 years from the administration of John Kennedy through that of George Herbert Walker Bush. During the 80s, McGovern prepared the president's daily briefing and briefed the vice president and secretaries of state and defense. McGovern is a founding member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, an organization formed by former intelligence officers dismayed with the assessments of intelligence prior to the war on Iraq.
Well, with respect to Vice President Cheney, he led the charge last summer, beginning with his very strong speech on August 26th. The charge being the offensive, the campaign to make sure that Congress would be frightened into voting to allow our president to conduct an unprovoked war. Part of that exercise involved the use of material known to be fraudulent, the material from the forgery. And that was employed on the Hill. So when you're thinking about the State of the Union address, well, that's bad enough, folks. That's pretty bad, and I can explain the ironies of that. But it pales in comparison with the misuse or the use of this disinformation with our elected representatives. And that's what happened starting at the end of August, all through September, right up until the vote on the 11th of October. The only thing they had was this mushroom cloud scare And the only evidence, in quotes, to support that was this fraudulent information about Niger. If this president asks a question, as night follows the day, he gets an answer. I mean, makes sense? Of course it does. So the prospect of Vice President Cheney expressing great interest in this issue, Ambassador Joe Wilson being sent down to Niger to investigate, and then coming back, and the vice president's office says, oh, by the way, we're not interested in the answer. Don't tell us the answer to it. We're not really, that, you know, that strains credulity beyond the breaking point. Condoleezza Rice is saying, well, our speechwriter, he wanted to figure out what to say in the State of the Union about Iraq, nuclear, and so forth. And so I gave him the NIE. I gave him the National Intelligence Estimate. Now, under ordinary circumstances, that would be golden. A graduate student could take the estimate and figure out what to say. The problem, my friends, was the information in the estimate had already been cooked. The information from that forgery had no place. Colin Powell seems to like to brag about having spent 4 days and four nights at CIA headquarters right before he made his speech on the 5th of February. That is bizarre. In my day, we did our analysis among ourselves. We knew what the requirements were. We knew what the interests were on the part of the policymakers. But thank you very much. We didn't need any policymakers at the table to tell us how to shape the analysis. So the prospect that as late as the 1st of February, that Colin Powell had to go up to the CIA and work with all this evidence to figure out which ones he wanted to choose, that's a usurpation of the intelligence process. He shouldn't have had to do that. It's crazy. This right before the war, the CIA didn't have something that Powell could rely on. It's really bizarre. The folks that have been appointed since William Casey and Bobby Gates became directors are more malleable folks, and they like to sniff which way the wind is blowing. And so you have too many of those around now throughout the intelligence community. And now, if I'm an analyst, and that kind of supervisor is next to me, I'm scared out of my wits.
Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst for 27 years and a founding member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Also joining the briefing was Andrew Wilkie, a senior intelligence analyst at Australia's Office of National Assessments, or the ONA, until his resignation a week before the war in Iraq. Wilkie resigned in protest against the way intelligence was used to justify Australia's support for the war. Wilkie's responsibilities included analysis of weapons of mass destruction and global terrorism. He said that he had virtually unrestricted access to the intelligence database of Australia and, as such, had access to the intelligence of the British, America, and Australia.
My own Prime Minister has said that he believes Australians have moved on, and your President has claimed that the matter is closed. I find statements like that from the senior leadership of the two countries as incredibly arrogant, and I find those sorts of comments incredibly insensitive to the enduring concerns of the many people in the United States and in Australia who are concerned with the fact that we appear to have participated in a preemptive attack on a sovereign state without international backing and on false pretenses. What they want least is that the focus should now move to what I describe as the two core issues about this whole Iraq mess. The first core issue is that we were all sold a war in Iraq on the basis of Iraq possessing a massive arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, not programs. Of course, that arsenal has not been found, and I'm confident that whatever will be found now will be a long way short of the massive arsenal of weapons that was used as the basis for the war. The second core issue is the fact that the second of the two pillars for this war was the claim that there was active cooperation between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. I served in Australia's senior intelligence agency for a total of 3 years. In that time, I saw not a single piece of credible, hard intelligence to substantiate the claim of any cooperation between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. The whole Iraq mess has been characterised by a systematic misuse of intelligence, of twisting of the truth, of picking and choosing only those pieces of information and intelligence that suit our government's purposes, and from time to time instances of downright dishonesty. the claim that Iraq was attempting to procure uranium from Niger. That information was well known to both a range of both US and Australian government departments and intelligence agencies before it was used by the US President in his State of the Union address and before it was used by my Prime Minister in his address to Parliament in early February. In fact, in only the last week, the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs, the Australian Department of Defence, and my former employer, the Office of National Assessments, have all conceded that they were in possession of that information before it was used by my Prime Minister. I find it completely unbelievable that we're being asked to believe that a piece of information, the critical piece of information about Iraq's nuclear ambitions, was known in a raft of agencies and departments in Australia, in Canberra and in Washington, but yet we're being asked to believe that the President didn't know about that, the Vice President didn't know about that, the National Security Advisor didn't know about that, my Prime Minister didn't know about that, my Foreign Minister didn't know about that. I offered the judgments then, about a week before the war, that based on the intelligence I was seeing, there was no doubt that Iraq's conventional military was weak and no threat to anyone, that its weapons of mass destruction program was, as I described at the time, disjointed and contained and a long way short of the national program that Iraq had in place prior to the 1991 war, and also that point that I saw no evidence of any active cooperation between Iraq and al-Qaeda. And in fact, one of a number of things that really moved me finally to resign was the US Secretary of State's mischievous presentation to the Security Council on the 5th of February, where he painted a picture of northeastern Iraq crawling with al-Qaeda who'd fled out of Afghanistan and poisons factories and so on. What the Secretary of State failed to emphasise appropriately was that whole northeast corner of Iraq was an area outside of Saddam's control. So it may well have been any other country. It wasn't Iraq. Those sorts of qualifications were noticeably missing from both the oral statements and written statements offered by the leaders in London, Washington and Canberra when they were arguing the case for war. I would characterise that statement, like many statements over the last many months, as a gross exaggeration to justify a war that was going to occur for other reasons.
Andrew Wilkie, a senior intelligence analyst at Australia's Office of National Assessments. Thanks to Josh Chaffin of Free Speech Radio News for preparing that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.